Our next chair is Sue, and from Guildford. He crept in.
Are we off?
Yes.
My name's Sue, I'm an alcoholic. It's lovely to be here. Lovely to be sitting beside Mick. And we had a nice little chat before the convention started, remembering. And when you read out that list of people that you remember, random list, you know, I knew quite a few of them. And there were times in the late 70s when we used to come over from Buckinghamshire, where we were. There weren't that many meetings. And I can remember coming over, like, mob-handed, and we come to the meeting here, or we go to Oxford. And one of the people that I would like to be on that list is Tom, Black Tom.
Yeah.
Because he was such a stalwart around Amersham and the Chesham area. And not here to tell his story, but he helped an awful lot of people. He, when he first came into the fellowship, he walked from Chesham to Aylesbury to get to a meeting. Eventually, you know, the social services helped him, but when I came, I started off my recovery in Bristol, and I'll go back to that in a minute. And at about 10 months sober, my husband and I got back together, and we moved up to the Amersham area. And I walked into Amersham Thursday one evening, and there were four people there, one of whom was Tom. And I was quite shaky, 10 months without a drink, moving to a new area. I thought I'd manage it very well. When I got there, I thought, I don't know anybody. You know, I don't know who to phone and all the rest of it. And I walked into that meeting, and Tom was there. He was secretary of the meeting. Just a normal welcome. But when I heard him share, I felt safe. I knew that Tom knew what he was talking about. I knew that if I was in a room where Tom was, you know, there was going to be a message that I could relate to and that would give me hope. Because, you know, I wasn't a very quick starter, and as I say, I was quite fragile at that time. And then as years went on, we travelled a lot together. I did the driving, he did the navigating, so to speak. And, you know, we went lots of places, and I was saying earlier on, wherever you went with Tom, you could go to Bedfordshire, you could go up the Blue Bonnets or wherever you were, and there'd be somebody come out of the bushes and say, "Hello, Tom, my old mate, how are you?" And he was well known and well loved in the fellowship, and very much part of my life in recovery. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in the summer of 1974, and I came because my husband couldn't stand me drinking anymore, and I had not chosen to inform myself about alcoholism. If something came on the radio, I'd turn it off. And my husband had got books, great bookman, and he got books out of the library about women's brains being smaller than men's, and, you know, livers and all the rest of it, and how women were more inclined to get out of hand with their drinking than men. I don't know where that information came from, because it's completely untrue. And he'd hide these books. He'd hide them in places where I couldn't find them. And I was hiding my bottles in places where I thought he couldn't find them. And that really started when we got married, because I was already drinking. I was married at the age of 20, and I was already drinking alcoholically, I know now. I was probably what you might call bouting then. It was attached to social occasions, but once I took the first drink, I couldn't stop. I'd watch other people and I'd think how boring they were. And add into that a huge capacity for alcohol. At the time, I had a huge capacity for alcohol. I hadn't sort of blown it by that time. And I just thought, these people keep being sick, you know. It's they fall over, they get in a muddle. And I was just standing there and I thought I was fine. I started drinking with my dad. He was a farmer. We used to go to the pub after haymaking and harvest and all that sort of stuff. Sunset, you know, dew coming down, tractor in the shed, let's go to the pub. Lovely, lovely. And my dad had lots of friends. Well, he seemed to have lots of friends. And my drinking really started in my mid-teens with him and his mates in the pub. Now, you can't get into an awful lot of trouble when you're drinking with your father. And, you know, he was a popular man, and people used to say to me, it takes a lot to fill those long legs of yours and chip off the old block and all that sort of stuff. So my drinking was affirmed. You know, I was one of the boys, really, although I was a sort of a teenage girl. And I remember my first blackout, and it was when I was about 18, and I borrowed a van from the farm to take a work colleague, or two work colleagues, out for the evening. Now, what had happened was I was working in the bank, and there was some other junior clerks there, and one of them was a guy. And he said to me, what are you doing at the weekend? And I said, don't know, really. And he said, well, my cousin's coming home from the Navy on leave. Why don't we all go on a pub crawl? Can you get a vehicle? So I borrowed a van from the farm, or a car, I can't remember what it was. And I picked these two guys up, and we went on the pub crawl. I seem to remember at some point we were in a ditch, and somebody towed us out. I think we had a good time. And I dropped them home to wherever they were staying and drove on home and thought, I've drunk those two under the table. And it was some sort of an achievement. But the following morning, my father said to me, who was sick in the van last night? And I said, I don't think anybody was. But I realised then, I didn't remember anyone being sick, but I didn't remember anyone being there either. And I was obviously driving around in what I learnt many years later was a complete blackout. and on and off, there's continued through my drinking years. And at first they frightened me, and then I became used to them. And that was the progression of my illness. I became used to the unacceptable. I became used to me lying and cheating. I became used to me taking money from the family. I don't think I stole from anyone else, but I'd take money from my husband's wallet. I'd take shamefully money from my children's money boxes. I'd hear them arguing about who had taken the money out of the money boxes. And I never went and fessed up because I knew I couldn't repay the money that I pinched. And so, you know, my drinking, my stealing affected the relationship between my two children. For a period, they learned not to trust one another because of me. So, I got married. As I say, the whole thing started. I got married in 1960, and I had little winkle picker stiletto heels on. Into the church, onto the grating, got stuck. And my father and I had been having a little party before the meet, just a relaxer, you know, before the meet. So I was stuck there. And I thought it was hilarious. I'd had enough to drink to think that this was a really funny thing to happen. Started to giggle. My husband was at the altar, looked round, and eventually somebody rescued me, and I got there. And afterwards he said to me, I smelt you coming up the aisle, he said. And I said, Elizabeth Arden Bluegrass. He said, no. Gordon's gin. And that was true, actually. So we were going on honeymoon to Scotland, and we were on the station waiting for the train. And he said, your case is awfully heavy. So I picked up his case, and his case was awfully heavy as well. So he said he'd look in my case to see what made it so heavy. Well, two bottles of champagne and a few clothes that didn't really fit because I'd gone shopping for my honeymoon outfits when I had been drinking. And I decided I was several sizes smaller than I actually was. And in his case were 16 library books. Maximum number he could take out on his ticket at that particular time. He intended to make use of his honeymoon. He would read quite a lot, which upset me, of course, because I needed to be the focus of his attention, at least for a few days. Anyway, that was the beginning. We were married for 24 years. It was a books and bottles situation, but it was also progressive alcoholism. Me sort of turning into this person that I think you mentioned it, you didn't really recognise. And personality changes, terrible fear. I was, you know, I was a bit of a neurotic child. I was, you know, illegitimate and adopted, and I put everything, all my problems down to that. And, you know, it isn't, you know, I was an alcoholic, and that was it. I had, you know, very fearful, very neurotic, couldn't talk without a drink. And once I'd had a couple of drinks, I just thought I liked myself better and other people liked me better. And it was a medicine. It really was a medicine. It was also a fun thing. Fun for a long time. But things started to happen. We were married. We moved away up to the Midlands. And after about a year, I became pregnant. And I had been drinking very heavily during that pregnancy. I worked with people who drank heavily. I thought I'd, you know, found the place I really wanted to be. And our little girl was born very severely handicapped. And I was not able to deal with it at all. I shut down completely. I knew that I did not have the wherewithal as a person to look after this very severely handicapped child. If I thought about it at all, I looked to the future and I thought, I'm not going to cope. I'm going to be one of these mothers that gets written about in the paper. I couldn't share that with my husband. He too was very devastated at our poor little girl. We were in and out of hospital and in and out of the doctors for the 10 months that she lived, and then she died. And I think that was, I can't blame that, but I think that was when I came to realise I had absolutely no resources of my own to deal with anything. Looking back, you know, with the benefit of hindsight and inventories and things, I always was flaky. I never really had a focus on what I wanted to do. I was always leaning on other people to support me. And I look at my motive for marrying, and I married a very solid man who had a career planned ahead of him, who was a kind man, and I knew he'd look after me. Did I love him? I'm not sure. I don't think I was capable of actually loving anybody at the time. And when I did my first inventory, the lady I did it with, she said, Sue, do you realise every decision you've made up until this point in your life was a fear-based decision? And I found that hard to accept. But, you know, with the benefit of somebody helping me look, I could say she was right. Fear drove me. And, you know, that fear took quite a long time to go. But she gave me techniques. But let's just talk about first coming into the fellowship, because we're talking now about, you know, old timers. And I'd like to record the old timers that I met when I first came into Bristol. Now, Travers was a controversial character. He was much loved and much hated by many people. But my husband took me to see him, just happened to be him. It wasn't designed to be him. And we sat either side of the table. And my husband had been going to Al-Anon for a year. I have to say, I didn't even notice he was gone, but there you go. And he went to find out how he could stop me drinking. And, of course, they told him he couldn't do that, but he could help himself. So he'd been going to Al-Anon for a year, and he must have caught me on a very weak day where I had nothing left to argue about. And he said, will you come and see somebody with me? And I must have said yes, and off we went. And we went to the Council on Alcoholism in Bristol, where Travers was probably director, you know, he'd like to be double director or something like that, but he was a director. And he was a retired actor, very beautiful in his own sort of way, and the most wonderful blue eyes. And it was summertime, and as I remember it, he was wearing shorts. And blue eyes and men's legs are just the right place to be, aren't they, when you're feeling a bit pissed off. So I was riveted, and he looked across the desk at me, and he said, Sue, you're an alcoholic. He said, I could leave it for you to make up your mind, but I have a feeling we'd be here rather a long time. And he was right. And I heard this piece of news, and I looked behind me to see who he was talking to. who was this poor woman who'd got this diagnosis? Of course, there was nobody else in the room except me and my husband. And he said, alcoholism is an illness. It's a threefold illness. It's physical, mental, and spiritual, and you've got it. And it's also terminal. So you had to, you know, absorb this piece of terminal was quite a good bit of drama, wasn't it, really? What a terminal illness. Be nice to me. Anyway, then came the sting. But it can be arrested one day at a time. If you come with me and my friends to Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, if you come to AA, and if you stay, and if you work the program to the best of your ability, I can guarantee you any one thing. I can't guarantee your husband's going to love you. I can't guarantee your children are going to be functional. I can't guarantee you're going to have a perfect job. But I can guarantee, if you do as suggested, you will have a life that befits a human being. Well, I probably had been drinking that day, and I was a topper-upper, so I didn't really give myself any gaps. I couldn't imagine what a life that befitted a human being might be. I knew I was mad. I knew I was terrified. I knew that I couldn't stop drinking. I thought, because I hadn't chosen to inform myself, that if ever I did put down the drink, I would be shaking for the rest of my life. I didn't realise that probably within a week, most of that would be over. Anyway, I hung around with this crowd, and I went to the meetings, and people were very kind to me. I treated a bit like a cocktail party and dressed up and swanned in and was vivacious, particularly if I'd had something to drink that day. You know, I was a total wreck. And, you know, I used to ring people up in the middle of the night and tell them it was all right for them. Not an easy newcomer. But Travis had connections, and this is what I want to talk about, because I didn't realise at the time that he was being sponsored by Sackville from Dublin, the coffee shop. And Sackville was a mover and shaker in Dublin. He was a lovely man. He came to Bristol once, and us newcomers were lined up to meet him. So and he was sponsored by Bill W. So I have shaken the hand of a man who has shaken the hand of Bill W. And I feel very privileged about that. It's something like dancing with the Prince of Wales, isn't it? Something like that. And he was very quietly spoken, and he shared in the evening. And Travis introduced him as his, you know, sponsor, his lovely sponsor. And he said, if you want to find him in the big book, and I think he's only in editions 1 and 2, you can find him between Annie the Cop Fighter and the Independent Blonde, which was so unSackville. I mean, he was such a gentleman, army officer and all that. Very, very quietly spoken. And as I remember thinking, well, what am I making such a fuss of this old geezer for? You know, everyone was sort of bowing and this and that and the other. And I'm sure his message was great, but I wasn't really fit enough to receive it. But I remember him coming, I remember his face, and I remember everyone being so pleased to see him. And, you know, then realising that, you know, that there was a link between him and Bill W., who I later came to find really, you know, a wonderful man. A wonderful man that he co-founded the fellowship, and a wonderful man that he wasn't afraid to admit his you know, defaults and his, you know, the problems that he had in his recovery. And so that was when I'm trying to think really. Yeah, I came in, as people have said, I sat on the hyphen. I was powerless over alcohol, but I didn't really get my life being unmanageable. Anne Walsh calls that sitting on the hyphen. And I listened to people's stories, and I knew that they were telling the truth. They were amazingly dramatic. Some of them were incredibly funny. We were talking about the comedians beforehand, weren't we? And to actually laugh, to sit there and laugh with somebody who was laughing at themselves, was such a release. I never thought I'd laugh. And in fact, I hadn't laughed for many, many years. My husband and I had had 2 more children, and they were fit and well, but they were also affected by my drinking. They were affected by the fact that, you know, they never knew what was going to happen. We'd got over the stealing from their money boxes, but you know, I was unpredictable, I was a bit wild. Sometimes I was there on time, sometimes I wasn't, sometimes I got lost. And so, you know, they always went to school with clean underwear and hair brushed and all the rest of it. But I was not there for them emotionally. And, you know, that has followed them through into adult life. Of course I've, you know, made amends and done my best. But just recently, actually, and I'm dotting about all over the place, but just recently my 51-year-old daughter, she was 11 when I came in, she's now 51, 52 next week. She said to me, she said, "Mum, you've been great with your amends. You know, she's had some difficult times in her life, and my, you know, I've had an opportunity to make amends offered to me really on many occasions, and hopefully I've been there." But she said, "The one thing that you didn't do, and that still bothers me," and I think she was quite angry about it actually, "is that I hadn't said to her that I'd empathised with her feelings when she was a child, when I was drinking." And I think that was true, because I listened to people in Alcoholics Anonymous who had alcoholic parents and how it affected them. And I empathise, and I understand, and I feel the fear, and I feel the confusion, and I feel the bewilderment that goes around, you know, a home that has alcoholic drinking. And I suppose, in a way, she was right. I hadn't empathised with her feelings. I'm ashamed to say that now, because, you know, I was 40 years in recovery before this came to light. But I have to share that with you, because I felt like I was shocked when she said that to me, because I felt that I'd been a, you know, good recovering AA member and very devoted to the program for a long time and very grateful to the program. So I talked to one or two people, including my sponsor, about this, because we were in Ireland at the time. And I said, just we'll talk about it later. I can't deal with it now. Because she was quite aggressive, her approach was quite aggressive, and I suppose it was because she wanted to get it out, and she thought, if I don't do it now, I'm never going to do it. You know, I could see where it was coming from. And I talked to several people, and some people said she needs a good slap, and other people said, no, it's a chance for you to really, you know, complete your amends. She feels that you haven't. So I did that, and I went to see her a few weeks later. And you know, by arrangement, we knew what we were going to do. And I said, can you tell me about it? Can you tell me about how you feel and that, you know, how it's affected you? And she told me about the confusion and the unmanageability. And she said, even when nice things were happening, like going shopping for Christmas presents or something, she said, I never knew when we were going to get through it without things kicking off. She remembers that when my husband was away, you know, various people came to stay the night, and she didn't like that. And of course it was unsettling. And, you know, as she got to the end of it, and it wasn't like blaming, she was just saying how she felt. And I said to her, you're absolutely right. There's nothing there that I don't remember. There's nothing there that didn't happen. I was, you know, she hadn't created any problems at all. It was just something that she'd been carrying around for a long time. And I said, you know, I'm really sorry that, you know, you've been carrying that around for so long, and I didn't realise. Can you actually forgive me for my behaviour then, and not, you know, not having that awareness? And she said, well, Mum, it's not really a case of forgiveness. I just wanted you to know. And I've shared that quite a lot at meetings, because just in case anyone's in that position, really, with their children, having difficulty maybe with adult children, it's a route to go down that I'd never really thought of. Anyway, back to early recovery. I was with the Travers crowd. I got powerlessness over alcohol. I hadn't really got the unmanageability. And then Travers said to me, have you got a higher power, Sue? And by this time I'd been to a few meetings, and I thought, I don't think any higher power would have anything to do with me. So I said, I don't really know. He said, I'll tell you what, borrow mine. And he handed me a small card with a serenity prayer on. And I had a borrowed higher power. And because he was so charismatic, and I thought, you know, he really liked me and wanted me to be well. He wanted me to be well, but I don't think he really liked me. I took the serenity prayer card and I stuck it in my pocket. And I walked out into life with this borrowed higher power. And it's, you talked about a trick. and this is a trick, you know, lend somebody your higher power. They haven't got the nerve to say, I don't want it. You see what they want. Anyway, he said, communicate with your borrowed higher power by using the serenity prayer. It's so simple. I can't, you know, just so easy. So I did. And, you know, when I felt like having a drink, or when I felt like I was going to overreact to a situation, or when I didn't know what to do, or, you know, I got open time and, you know, shall I drink or shall I not drink? I'd take this serenity prayer and I'd read it. I couldn't remember it. And I'd read it. God grant me the serenity to set the thing. And often by the time I got halfway through, the brain had sort of cleared a bit. And I was able to think, now, what am I going to do now? And I thought, my goodness, this prayer thing works. Really works. So one of the women in the group said to me, she was actually an Al-Anon member, but she was very close, and she said to me, you need to do an inventory, Sue, because you're carrying around so much rubbish. You're carrying around all this fear, all this self-pity, all this resentment, all this negativity. If you carry on like that without trying to get rid of it, you're going to drink. Inevitably, you're going to drink, because the pain of it is just going to be too, you know, too difficult to resist. You're going to have to blank out the pain. So she said, what we're going to do is, I want you to do, it's a life story, actually. And she said, just write everything down. Don't worry about punctuation, this, that, and the other. Just write it down. News of the world stuff. And so I did my best with that. And there was a little group going on there in the Council on Alcoholism in Bristol. It was a daily attendance, I don't know, facilitated group by counsellors. And so there were other people there who were newcomers, and we all heard each other's inventory, as such as it was. And we had little tick sheets about, you know, overwhelmed with self-pity, resentment, fear. And a lot of people ticked me, lack of sincerity. Lack of realising what was actually wrong. You know, I was drifting around a bit like a princess, thinking, oh, this is fun. And people are being nice to me. But they got me. They got me. And I've still got those sheets. I can't bear to throw them away. And they, generally speaking, people used to call me a phony. You're a phony. You're not prepared to go to any lengths. Da, 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 da. But I still hung around. And after I'd done this inventory with this, and the group had assessed, you know, what a shit I was, and this lady had gone through it with me, and she said, self-pity, gratitude list. That'll get rid of your self-pity. Fear, faith, practice your faith. Resentment, prayer for the person or the institution. It says it in the big book. Doesn't necessarily take it away, but it relieves its power. And it's true. And amazingly, and, you know, I found myself doing stuff that was suggested. Now, you were a teacher, John, and I was, the final 2 years of my drinking, I thought I'd show my husband that I wasn't the idiot that he thought that I was. And I applied for a mature student teacher training course. And much to my terror, I got accepted. I'd had about half a bottle of sherry before I went for the interview, and I knew exactly what kind of person they were looking for, and it was me, and they agreed. And lots of other women were, I mean, it was about 300 places for, you know, 300 applicants for 12 places or something, and Muggins gets accepted. And I drove away from the interview thinking, bloody hell, I've done it now, you know. I knew I wasn't going to last. And I got home and I told my husband I was going to be a teacher, and he said, what? He said, you're always grumbling about them. I said, if you can't meet them, you know, beat them, join them. And there I was. And I stayed the course. I came out with merit, I think. I remember very little. But what I did know was I was clever. And when somebody gave me the big book to read, I had just completed a paper on Freud's theory of personality in the infant classroom. I didn't agree with it, actually, because I didn't think Freud was really up to it. But give me that book, and I think, so so badly written. And that was my attitude for quite a long time. And I have to say, I was rescued from that primarily by Joe and Charlie and the Big Book Studies, and because they brought it to life, and they, you know, they read it with understanding, and I love it now. And if ever I have somebody new come to me and said, can you take me through the programme, I just look forward to going through, as you say, the doctor's opinion, Bill's story, and and just, you know, absorbing it all. And I love to see people, you know, when they sort of let their eyes light up and it resonates for them. The doctor's opinion is particularly, I think, you know, the allergy and all the rest of it. After about 10 months, my husband and I got back together, and he was moved up to Northwood to work in Northwood. And that was when I met Tom, who I talked about at the beginning of the meeting, and went to the Amisham meeting. And Elsie, who's another terrible member, Elsie, said to me, oh, there's a new meeting started up in Beaconsfield, why don't you go there? So I went off on Tuesday to Beaconsfield, and Terry will remember this, because they were just changing offices, and he said, would you like to do the literature? And I said, yeah, I'd like to do the literature, because I was moaning on about, I was in a new area, and I didn't know anybody, and it was busier than the West Country, and I couldn't drive, you know, all the usual rubbish. And yeah, I'd like to do the literature. And I think I did this deliberately, I can't remember, but I missed the meeting for a couple of weeks. I didn't go. And I thought, you know, he'll come and say, well, we really do need you, Sue, and, you know, please come along. Where the fuck have you been? If you want to do this job or don't you? And I have to say that I started off, I haven't talked much about the tough love in Bristol, but there was tough love there. I needed tough love. I needed somebody to tell me I was an alcoholic and I was going to bloody die if I didn't do something about it. And that's what I was told. And, you know, I went back and I did the literature. I can't remember whether I did it well or badly. I don't think I was one of these perfectionists who had to have everything in rows. I suspect it was rather the other way. But that was when I became a member, a proper member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I had a home group. And I think home groups are terribly important, because it's easy to swan around and be a guest everywhere, isn't it? And nobody really gets to know you. They told me that in Bristol. They said, when you go to your new area, you must get a new sponsor and get a new home group. And that was good advice. Didn't take it immediately, but Beaconsfield Tuesday became my home group for many years. And a bit later on, I was offered the enormous privilege of being secretary of that group. And that meant I was trusted. I was trusted to get there on time, to find the speakers, to, you know, have the meeting run certain and finish on time, take people's phone numbers, be prepared to ask people to speak, and if they said no, it wasn't anything personal, they probably were doing something that night, it wasn't a personal rejection. I learned an awful lot, and it gave me a huge amount of confidence that I never really had. I wouldn't say I'd lost my confidence, I don't think I really ever had any confidence. And I remember one of the young men in the very early days when I was in Bristol, he's much younger than me, but he shared that he never really knew who he was. He went through life not really knowing who he was. And a lot of us, you know, say you came through life not having the manual of how to do it. But he described, he said, I never really knew who I was. And then when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought, I'm an alcoholic. I can start there. And that really got to me, and I thought, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. I can start there. I can learn how to be a recovering alcoholic. Because at some point I'd gone from being terrified of being drunk to wanting to be sober, and that's a big difference. I went to a meeting, before I left Bristol, I went to a meeting in Chippenham in Wiltshire on a Thursday evening, a funny little meeting, and two of the men from the group had offered to pick me up and take me over there, and I went really because I didn't dare say no. And I sat in that meeting where I didn't know anybody, I can't remember who was in the chair. I went in with the usual negative attitudes. I hadn't changed at that point. I hadn't been pointed to altered attitudes or anything like that. It was before that. And I heard nothing at all. But partly through the meeting, I just sat back and thought, I feel different. So I'm talking a bit out of context here. This is before I did my first inventory. And I knew, it's just like a deep breath and the weight off my shoulders. It didn't last forever, but I just knew that if I wanted to ever feel that feeling again, I'd never felt it for a long, long time, it would be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It had to be. And I could, it was about then that I, you know, put down the drink and I could look back in retrospect 3 months to that occasion and I thought, what was that all about? It was about feeling hope. That's what I got in that meeting. I don't know how or where or how, but I did. I felt hope. And that really led me on to continue to go to meetings. As I say, I did this inventory with this woman and she gave me three strategies how to deal with my main problems at that particular time. Then I went to Beaconsfield, then I got involved in service, and then I had a home group. I was a member. I was prepared at that point to go to any lengths. I knew that I was an alcoholic. I knew that the only way that was going to work for me was Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've held that faith, you know, for a long time now. I find it absolutely amazing to be sitting up here being called an old timer, because you know, when I came in, again, back down to Bristol, there was a chap there who was a priest, and he was training to be a counsellor. And he turned out to be my mole, you know, and he'd come to me and he'd say, Sue, you know, they don't think you've got a snowball's chance. And I said, well, why is that then, Pat? He said, because of your fucking attitude, he said, you know. And, you know, there's a bit of it, I'll show them, but I'll show them doesn't get you sober. I'll show them gives you a bit of oomph, but it doesn't keep you sober. Surrender, actually, is the point at which things start to happen, at least in my experience, surrender. And I probably surrendered that day when my husband took me over to somebody who could help me. And then I was helped by the fact there was a very attractive man sitting behind the desk offering me life. I mean, no, it wasn't as simple as that. So the service became very important in my life, and I was very lucky to have meet some people at the Beaconsfield meeting who were long-standing friends, one of whom is here today, a great surprise. My sponsor, Sonia, who I was in touch with during the week, because she was in this chair this time last year, I believe. And I feel enormously privileged just to be sober today, let alone, you know, the number of years. It was not predicted that I would make the program at all, and it just shows, you know, never, no such thing as a hopeless case. I wasn't hopeless because I'd been on the streets and, you know, I'd lost my brain and my liver was hanging out. It was none of that. It was because I had this bloody-minded, petulant attitude, and a bit like you said, I knew it all when I knew nothing, and I know very little today, and I like to sit and learn. I think if I think I know stuff, if I get a bit mouthy and start telling people what to do, it never really works. I have to retain that teachability and that humility that is required of a newcomer. Talking about this priest, my first meeting was actually at a retreat up in Staffordshire, and I think they were some kind of monks there. They wore brown robes and things. So I go up there, and I'd probably about 2 days off the drink, and I'd been a topper-upper probably for 10 years. So, you know, things were a bit dodgy. And I got out of the car, and I saw one of these monks walking across the car park. And I shut my eyes and looked again. He was still there. And nobody told me much, or maybe they told me and I hadn't listened. I don't know. So they took me to my room, which was like a little cell, really. Looked out of the window, it was getting dark, lights going across at sort of treetop level, up and down, very quiet, no sound, nothing. They've come to get me. They're here at last. The mothership is out there, I'm going home. Because that's what I felt, I was an alien, an absolute alien. So somebody knocks on the door and he says, you come into the meeting then, Sue? And I said, well, I'll come until I have to go. And she said, have to go where? I said, well, they're out there. They've come to collect me. She said, Sue, those lights, you're facing onto a canal, and those lights are the sort of on top of the masts of the barges going up and down. that's what they know, you know. Anyway, first meeting, Friday night, top table platform. This priest, who I hadn't really got to know yet, sitting up there sharing with dog collar on. And I sit there in a rage, absolute rage, not because it's a Catholic priest, but because nobody told me it was fancy dress. Funny things, amusing stories, but I was a terrified person. I thought I was mad. I wanted to be locked away. I wanted to be locked away, preferably somewhere comfortable so I couldn't do any more damage. I couldn't visualise. I'd go to meetings, I'd hear people share about their recovery and what they were doing, and I think, gosh, they're marvellous, but, you know, I'm not made of that stuff. I'm a weak, stupid, shallow woman, and I always will be. Actually, I'm not. But I'm not because, you know, I've come to try, and to the best of my ability, to live the AA program. And I hope that I've changed. I think I have changed. I must have changed. Yeah. So, carrying on, the big book studies really opened up the... Time do you want me to stop, mate?
But 12 past 12.
All right. Opened up... a new world for me with the big book, and I'd always enjoyed the 12 and 12. I'd been to, when I was living in Beaconsfield, I used to go to the step meeting every Sunday night, and I sort of felt I knew the 12 and 12 off by heart. Knowing the books off by heart is not really any good. It's working the books, it's understanding, and you know, each time I read that book with myself or with somebody else, I get a fresh understanding of, you know, maybe about what step four is about, what step five, six, and seven. They're quite complicated, six and seven. They don't have to be, but they can be. And it's, you know, my character defects are still there. I still hold them, but I have an awareness about them now. I have an awareness that if I start feeling sorry for myself, I'm reverting to type. I've gone to default setting. There's no reason for me to feel sorry for myself. And there is always a solution, and I love the fact that, you know, AA offers me the solution for me, Sue the alcoholic, who could not manage her own life. I don't think about drink, really, these days. I don't come across it very much, because most people know that I don't drink, and I haven't drunk for a long time. But just occasionally, you know, I go to the U3A, and I joined a writer's group there, and it was okay. And then they started planning the summer party in January and the da-da-da-da-da. And I just thought, I can't do this. I really can't. You know, I'll find another writer's group where they don't, you know, the focus is not on drink. It's my policy to avoid those situations if I possibly can. But where I'm in it, you know, I can manage it. I don't really think about it. I plan what I'm going to ask for before I go. My husband was very good in the early days, and he always went to get me a tonic because he was, you know, a government scientist, and we had to go to sort of formal dinners and things. But now, if you walk in, if there's anyone new here today, if you walk into somewhere and they say red or white, you just say, have you got a soft drink? Or have a bottle of water in your bag. It's you know, we have to look after our illness, take responsibility for it, and take responsibility for our recovery, and that's what I try to do. The family, I mean, I've just described the situation with my daughter, which, you know, I found quite difficult. Not everybody agreed with me saying, can you forgive me? I had some very stern people saying, it's not necessary. But I had to go the way that I felt was right for me. And she's coming to stay tonight, actually, and... a few weeks after that confrontation and that time when we sat down and I asked if she could forgive me, I needed to go to London to have a hospital appointment. And I needed to stay overnight somewhere. She had a flat in London. And I said to her, you know, I'm going up to get this back injection. Any chance you could come and pick me up and if I could stay the night because I can't drive after it? Yes, Mum, of course. Because what I wanted to do was to not be treading on eggshells around this situation. I hope it's dealt with. It may well spike again, I don't know. But I cannot walk around my daughter, who's, you know, coming up 52 years old, on eggshells waiting for something to happen. And I'm trying to get the relationship back to a mother and daughter. It's never going to be perfect, but, you know, I could, fear would have taken me away from that situation. And I thought, I've got to have courage and just deal with it. My son, a different kettle of fish, I've talked to him about the past. He's now 50. He has I don't know whether it's his way of dealing with it, but he just said, Mum, it was ages ago, you were ill, it's over. That's how he feels about it. And, you know, he's lovely and he's very kind to me, helps support me in a lot of ways. My ex-husband, we got divorced in 1984. He's been with somebody for a long, long time. We went together to a friend's funeral the other day, and he offered to come down and pick me up, take me down there to Dorset, and we had a very reasonable day. You know, relationships are healed. There is the wherewithal in the program to heal relationships. There's the wherewithal in the program to heal oneself. I know that I will always be learning. I've learned already today something, and I'm looking forward to the next speakers, and I'm going to stop there because I know I'm rambling on.
Thank you, Sue. Thanks very much. Yeah, I can, you know, you were on about making amends, and I went up to my mother, you know, and I said to her, I'm sorry for all the harm I caused you before I drank, because I was in more trouble with the police and everything before I drank, and then when I drank. And all she turned around and said to me was, if you stay in your club, I will be the happiest person in the world. She wouldn't have me called an alcoholic, and she wouldn't let me say that I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I spent ages trying to make her say that I was an alcoholic, and I went to AA, until I thought, does it really matter? You know? And you spoke about shaking the hands. My first sponsor, Eve of Henley, she actually met Lois, you know, and I kind of envied her, because I thought, if she ever comes to England and Eve knows her, then I got one over in Sylvie, because being an Al-Anon, I can say, I met Lois, you haven't. But, you know, but she was a fantastic woman. She didn't drive, and I drove. And, of course, there was only two of us in Henley, in AA, me as a newcomer, and her, who was, I think she was about 4, 5, 6 years sober, you know. And so she'd get all the AA calls, and I'd get a call from her to be the chauffeur. And I used to say to her, Eve, I won't know what to say. And she used to say, Mick, if I shut up or dry up, you come in. Well, she could talk for England, so I had no worry. And, you know, older members and that. She said to me one day, she said, we'll go over to see Bill at Bampton. Now, Bill had his, at the AA meeting in his house. And he was kind of rather rich, because he had a butler that served you with tea and cake. And so we shoot off and we find where Bill lives, and knocks on the door, and the lady comes to the door, and Eve says, oh, we've come to the meeting to see Bill. She said, he's been dead a year. So we went all that way, and I've never met the man, you know, I was looking so forward. The butler mainly bit is what I was looking forward to, you know, just, you know, but, you know, there are so many wonderful stories in AA, isn't it? And this is what's great about this kind of, this, what's happening this weekend, is that we will hear these stories. They are being recorded, so that if anybody wishes to have a disc and that, you know, and we can build up the history of AA all around the place. And I think we're very lucky. And with that, I have a notice here. Someone with a white Fiat, you've left your sat-nav on display. And so someone gave me that earlier, and I was listening so engrossed in John's story and that I forgot to announce it. We can stop now for tea and coffee for a few moments, but we will resume about 12:30, 12:25, something like that. Okay, thank you very much.